You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Pablo Aguera. Pablo, thanks so much for being with me today. Brainerd, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. Pablo, I know you're working on a number of things, installation, sculpture, drawing, as well as writing. But let's talk about some of the projects you're involved with at the moment, or wherever you want to start with your activity.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, we are living in a very peculiar political moment, you know, and the project that I'm doing right now somehow connects very directly with it. It's an ongoing project that started about 3 years ago. It's called Libreria Donceles, and I am a big book lover. And I always am very attracted to used bookstores. And it has been very, very painful to me to see that where I live in New York City, used bookstores are disappearing. It used to be the mecca of used bookstores. Now we have the Strand left and a few other scattered places. Additionally to that, books in Spanish are very hard to get. And the last bookstore that sold books in Spanish exclusively closed in 2007. So I had this idea of starting a secondhand used bookstore in New York called Libreria Donceles, the name of which relates to this street in Mexico City downtown where it's lined up with used bookstores. And the reason why it connects to the political moment is because it really was a direct response to the anti-immigrant wave, where specifically anti-Mexican immigration, where it's fueled by sentiments of to condemn basically the cultural value that immigration brings into a country. So I wanted to show how I wanted to do two things with this project. One side, I wanted to show how complex any culture is in any language. The bookstore has books of anatomy, of agriculture, of philosophy, politics, sociology, things like that, you know. And then on the other hand, I wanted to also help the immigrant population in the city. And the books are basically available for pay what you wish basis, so you can get a book for a penny if you want. And then all the funds go toward any local organization that supports Latino culture or the Spanish language in some way. So it's a social practice project that started 3 years ago, as I said, and somehow it continued and has been having a life of its own, traveling around the country. We've been to Miami, to Phoenix, to San Francisco, to Seattle.
And to explain to me how it happens in each of those places. And of course, we should know, although people will know from reading this, that you're a Mexican native. You were born in Mexico as well. Is that correct?
Yes, I was born and raised in Mexico City, and I come from a family that was, let's say, very artistic, bohemian, but everybody was an artist or is an artist. And in that context, I mean, I was very attracted to books, or I mean, I grew up in an environment of books. So for me, books have always been a very important thing. And I also, I mean, we belong to this generation that is maybe the last analog generation, you know, where, when I was a kid, there was no internet, right? So books were really the really conduit for knowledge for me. Yeah? Anyway, so that's part of it. But the whole what happened basically with the project was that in New York City, as you know, rent is very high, very damn high, and it's very difficult to sustain a place for a long time. Basically, I transformed an art gallery into this bookstore, and it lasted for 2 months. And then, you know, there was time for them to really move on and do their next show. And I was left with 20,000 books. So I didn't know what to do. And suddenly a university museum in Arizona offered to do the project. And then we were able to get a storefront in somewhere in Phoenix to do the project. And so the project survived as an itinerant project, you know, where we brought all the books to the city and then became pretty much like the only Spanish used bookstore in the city by doing that. And that's how the project has continued. And now the project will open its last venue in Boston in January, and then we will be done for good for the project.
Very good. So the project won't exist in New York City anymore. It seems, in a way, such an important project to continue. I'm sorry to hear that it won't have more iterations, because, as you're saying, it seems so important.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's especially. I mean, like when I started the project, you know, there certainly was a, and especially places like in Arizona, there was where there was such a right wing government with the governor Jim Brewer, who was so anti-immigrant, and the sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was really he delighted in demeaning and diminishing and humiliating immigrants. It's so great that both these politicians are gone. However, as we know from Trump and other politicians that are in power right now, racism is unfortunately taking over our country, and we need to do everything we can, I think, as artists, to fight back. To me, the bookstore is a way of addressing and engaging with the issue that is not necessarily a confrontational way. Because I'm not completely convinced that the politics of confrontation are productive. Instead, this bookstore tries to invite people into like a very rich and fulfilling environment to discover other worlds, you know. And to me, that's a much more interesting and productive way to really engage anybody in a particular issue.
Yeah. I think so too. I was just talking with Julie Tremblay yesterday, and she was talking about a show in Sharjah in the United Arab Emirates, and she was near the United Arab Emirates, and she was saying how it's, you know, there it's such a culturally diverse place in there, and they're doing amazing things with art, and she said she just wished she could bring, you know, every Trump supporter there to show them what remarkable things that they're doing in there and in this Muslim culture, which, you know, as you're saying, it's important that it's about education, really, isn't it? I mean, about learning.
Well, it's in a way it's about a very American thing, which has to do with this cultural isolation that the middle America experiences. And, you know, I am calling you from Chicago, where I went to school, you know, in the Midwest. And I basically came of age in Chicago as an art student, you know, and an artist. And I feel that, you know, I have had an experience of middle America that is very different from the one would probably have in New York, that is really more like a bubble. Hmm. And, you know, I remember a number of years ago, I was visiting artists at a college in Pennsylvania, really in the middle of nowhere, you know, a Penn, you know, which is essentially just a college campus. And in the painting program, there was this student who was white American guy, young, you know, maybe 19 or so, 20. And the guy was making these incredibly racist paintings of Muslims. You know, this was around the time of the Iraq War, you know, so it was like 10 years ago or more, and the teacher, and that, I mean, basically, they were incredibly racist and demeaning paintings of Muslims, you know, and I talked to the teachers about this guy, you know, like, what is going on here, you know, and the teachers were like, well, that's his right to do that, you know, we can't stop him from making that. At the same time, this kid had never actually met a Muslim, you know, in his life. So he had no real sense of how, like, people who practice a different faith are regular people like us, you know. And he was very directed, in a way, by the dominant culture that he would see on TV and stuff, you know, to actually make that kind of work. So I guess my reflection on all that stuff is that, you know, this sort of racism and and white supremacy and things like that. It's mostly related to this isolation that is created within our communities when we don't really understand what it means to be different. You know, where we think we're taught that we all should actually aim or strive for some kind of specific model of being, you know. And there's a book by a sociologist called David Derby called Us and Them that describes very much this phenomenon of this sense of tribalism, where, you know, we identify ourselves, nationalism and religious identity is a way to kind of group ourselves into a certain kind of tribe, you know, and to also emphasize that whoever does not think like us, whoever doesn't look like us, is then the enemy, you know. This changes, of course, when you have a situation where, for example, you as a white male, and then someone else who is like maybe African American, travel together, let's say, or find yourself together in a foreign country, you know. Suddenly, you both are American. And suddenly you realize how many affinities you actually have with this other person, regardless of race. Like you have grown up with the same pop culture, you have grown up with similar history, you have the same precedents, you have the same kind of environment that brought you together. So it is really a contextual difference that arises, you know, and that it's important to recognize. But so I think whatever we can do as artists is to try to raise those tribalistic borders, you know, and try to create situations where different people can come together and then develop a better sense of or openness to what it means to be different.
I agree. I'm so glad you spoke directly about that as well. So there's many other projects that you've done, and I'd like to talk about at least one more. There's the Parable Project, if I'm saying that right. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so around 3 years ago, I was invited, 2 years ago, I was invited by BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, to do a performance. They do this festival called the Next Wave Festival, which is meant to showcase new work, of emerging fields and maybe experimental theater, let's say, and performance art. As a performance artist, as you know, like the traditional performance art is very different from theater, and this becomes very visible when you start dealing with a performing arts presenter that is used to present theater in terms of like shows, you know. They basically told me, like, you have to do this twice. You have to do one performance for 200 people, and then the next 2 hours later, you have to do the same performance for 200 people, you know? And, you know, performance art is very flexible and very elastic, you know? But it doesn't really function when you basically treat it like a theatrical production, in my view. I mean, it becomes theater, you know? So what I did is I decided to try to pre-select the 200 guests on each evening, or both evenings, and start corresponding with them a year in advance. So I try to have people commit to come to this event in a year from then, and then I started sending them regular letters. These are like old-fashioned letters stamped in the mail, each letter was different. So this was not a form letter. This was a very specific letter, and that was directed to that person that I tried to engage with, basing my knowledge on who they were as much as I could. Because the majority of the people who participated were people that I kind of knew or knew who they were. They were in the art world somehow. And they were also in strangers. But I basically tried to send them letters that were kind of like diary pages, things that I was thinking of at that given moment. Overall, I wrote around 4,000 letters and mailed over 4,000 letters. It was like a huge year-long project that nonetheless was really important to me. And the thing is that each letter
Just to get a sense of that, the scope of that, because that is huge. That's 4,000 letters in a year you sent out. And these are emails, or these are regular mail?
This was regular mail, actual letters that you go to the post office and stamp, you know, with a physical stamp and send by physical mail. And then people will start getting things in the letters, you know, little things like a little photograph or a picture or something, you know. And so it was very important for me to have, in the same way that, you know, the bookstore is about the physical connection with the physical object of the book. You know, it's kind of resisting the immediacy of the Kindle and the ebook. You know, and this was also trying to resist the conventions of email, and also re-embrace the things that letters do for us. Because if you really think about it, you don't really receive letters anymore. You know, we don't receive physical letters in the way we used to receive, like maybe 20 years ago. When I first came from Mexico, I would write long handwritten letters to my friends describing everything that was happening to me at that moment, you know. And they were very much incident, like other moments, where things are like, as I'm writing to you now, you know, it's just been Christmas, and, you know, I just wrapped all my presents or whatever, you know.
Right.
And in the email is very hard to talk that way, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah. You don't write an email to somebody saying, like, hi, I'm just sitting here, you know, thinking about, you know, the holidays, right. You know. The email, the conventions of email that require or demand that you have a very to-the-point issue to address. Like, I'm writing to you because this and this and that. You know? While the letter tends to have a little bit more of a literary bent, more of a, you know, today I'm in this cafe sitting and thinking about X, you know. So I liked that, in a way, meandering quality of letter writing, and then I decided to take that form for this project. So each letter told a parable, which was a parable is like a fable, right? It's a moralistic tale that, you know, the Bible is full of, you know. But this was obviously not a religious thing. It was simply a reflection about art. And then it just tells you a story. And then you kind of have to make your own conclusions to what the story means, you know. And the author doesn't really tell you anything about what's the morale of the story. This is, or what's the conclusion. You basically tell a story and leave it there, and then walk away, you know. And
but
I kind of like
these,
that.
But these parables, because I'm going to ask you to read one of them. This was sent to somebody via a regular letter as well, or no?
Yes. Everyone received one of these things via physical mail. Yes. So, for example, the one that I'm going to read to you right now, which, again, I think connects to the political moment, was sent to a friend of mine named Elaine Tinio. Elaine is an artist who lives in New York City, and she participated in the project, right? And, you know, some of the stories of the parables that I share kind of are maybe continuations of conversations that this person and I have had in the past, you know? And it was my desire also to see if I could really go a little deeper to what I feel is very superficial New York art world, where you see somebody at an opening and say hello and how are you doing and how's everything and very busy. Okay, goodbye. You know, you never really get to talk about more deeper things. You know? So anyway, here's one of the parables for Elaine Tinio. And it's just three, 4 minutes long. Dear Elaine, when one studies art, there's a general expectation that one should explore his or her interior voice. Be yourself, they say. Speak about what you know. It is unfortunate that this series of counsels reinforce a perception of the artist as someone primarily charged with exploring their inner world, an obsession that has been pretty much a constant in modernism. As a result, most of those who come to study art today are narcissists. And in art schools, we feed their narcissism by encouraging them to explore themselves. It doesn't help much that studying art is a class privilege. Only those who have enough money can spend time thinking about themselves and their problems, and art often becomes a way to validate an essentially selfish activity. I believe you know that for many years I have advocated for a very different kind of artist education, while I'm not against exploring our respective eccentricities, I believe that we should primarily teach how to see and listen and be affected by what one sees and hears. But I also know that obsession with altruism can have its own dangers and at times can be equally misplaced as a purely self-centered practice. Great and bad art results from self-obsession, but that is true also of public art. While it can be great and meaningful to all, it can also be tedious, lame, and colorless. So where does that put us, just to say that art can be either good or bad, regardless on whether you are selfish or not? Sounds like I didn't really contribute anything to this reflection, right? True. But what this previous non-conclusion might bring us is the idea that maybe the parameters to measure who should make art should change. For example, what if we had a rule that only interesting people could make art? Believe me, sometimes these thoughts cross my mind when I'm doing studio visits to young art students who come from very privileged backgrounds, who have no idea nor real interest about the outside world, and who are mostly concerned by their own personal issues that are typical of a life of privilege. If you will allow, I would like to share with you a story that may illustrate this problem. There once was a country with a dictatorship. Let's call the country Cyrus. Cyrus had been a mostly democratic country with a failing economy when a socialist party took over. This led to a right-wing military coup to seize power, after which the country was held under severe restrictions of freedom of expression. It was determined by the military junta of Cyrus that art was a danger to society, and only certain individuals would be allowed to study it, mainly individuals who would make art works that were decorative and non-threatening to the ideology of this dictatorship. Inevitably, this spurred an underground group of individuals who wanted to be artists, but were instead forced to go into other areas and felt less threatening to the regime's ideology, like architecture or commercial design. Regardless, these artists started to make incredibly imaginative and conceptual art about the dictatorship, bringing forth a golden age of art with an urgent message. Over the years, the dictatorship of Cyrus started faltering, and the happy day came when the regime came down and the people were able to achieve democracy again. A new democratic president was sworn in, and the country, while not perfect, initiated a period of stability and relative financial growth. The artists who belonged to that underground period became heroes and received a myriad of exhibitions and tributes. Entire museums were built dedicated to displaying their works. As they aged, some of these artists continued making the same kind of works they used to make, while others were attempting new forms. None were as successful as the works produced during those underground years. Their newer works lacked the edge and the urgency of the message of their initial works. Art schools were formed, and now everyone could study to be an artist. But the art students had a hard time following the act of those grandmasters who had fought the dictatorship with their art. There was not much to make art about in a country like Cyrus, who now had a boring president and an average society. As a result, the art spheres increasingly started veering towards architecture and commercial design. Recently, at a panel discussion, an art critic from Cyrus lamented the decline of the art practice in this country, reminiscing of the greatness of the art made then, reminding everyone that those who became the best artists were precisely those who had been denied the possibility to study art in the first place. If we ever want to produce great art again, the critic declared, Cyrus should consider having a second dictatorship. All yours, Pablo.
I love that. That's very appropriate to read now. It also seems like it could launch us into a conversation all about education, which perhaps we should have a part two of this interview and talk about education, because this is really what you're talking about there in part, right? Is also the education of the artist and what that means
it has a lot to do with the purpose of art, right? We have been talking about how in a way this moment, this political moment, resembles a lot the 80s, you know, when we had the culture wars, when artists were becoming critics of the social policies of the Reagan years, you know, when artists became advocates for awareness about AIDS and the other issues that were going on at the time, you know, and where artists were making works about the body, about gender, in moments where American society was really reluctant to deal with those things. Those things were taboo, right? And I think an ongoing thing you hear about is that how, in a way, Trump, the Trump era is going to be a harbinger to a very political type of art. So in a very sinister and way, you can say that Trump is actually an excellent gift for art, because you know it will give us material to work with. You know, sinister.
I think that's a very interesting perspective. I mean, and I've also heard that echoed in terms of just activism. Trump has ushered in an age which will most likely be, you know, more active than other political decades in recent history, you know, with the exception perhaps of the 80s, and as well as ushering in a whole new generation, millennials, who are experiencing this and will grow up under this and hopefully take a much more active role. Yeah, that's kind of fascinating. Yeah. and ironic.
Yeah, I mean, I think in my case, some of our cases of my of our generation, I think the Bush era prompted very political work, you know, that was a response to the Hurricane Katrina, to the Iraq War, to a lot of Bush policies of intervention in other countries. You know, I mean, that definitely was a very important context for many of us to make art about, you know, and that we tried to respond to that. And the Obama era, ironically, I mean, I think even though it was a Democratic president, what I think it prompted was really a reflection on the exacerbated tensions and cultural differences in the country, like the issues about race and things that we're now seeing, you know, coming to a head with the election of Trump. So, it's true that, you know, it's a conservative government inevitably becomes a very urgent and necessary phenomenon to respond to for an artist. So, and that's what this whole parable was about, really.
Yeah, I'm so glad you read that. I'd love to talk more about other projects, but I think I'm going to have to ask you the last question, which is, it also seems appropriate, and I'm interested to hear what your answer, which is, what books are you reading now, or book, or of any type at all?
Well, you know, I just did my little foray into used bookstores in Chicago, where I am, and I just bought The Dictionary of Superstitions by David Pickering. And I am very interested in developing some kind of like art dictionary, you know, in the style of Ambrose Bierce. I don't know if you know the Devil's Dictionary of Ambrose Bierce. It's a dictionary that is very cynical, that is kind of like a satire on American society in the form of a dictionary. And so I'm kind of looking at dictionaries right now and seeing how I can develop one myself. I am also very much into short stories, and I am doing a project about short stories and storytelling that will open in New York maybe in April. So I am reading a lot of short stories right now and trying to come to grips with the form and see how, as an artist, I can work with it. I don't want to be the challenge, as always, as an artist that reads, is I don't want to be a amateur writer, but I want to employ the form in a conceptual way, you know, in the same way that, you know, Lawrence Weiner works with language, you know, in a conceptual way without being a poet, you know. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of things I'm working on right now: short stories and dictionaries.
So it seems like, I mean, especially with the year of parables and writing and everything that you're involved in now, you're doing an enormous amount of writing still, right, as a part of your practice. Writing and reading seems almost a core of your practice. Is that correct to say?
Yes, yes. I do a ton of reading and a ton of writing. I had a brother who was a writer who passed away 13 years ago. And while he was alive, he was very important to me. He was like a teacher, was an older brother. And I had never attempted writing or doing anything related to writing because he was the writer. And then I realized that suddenly I had this urge to write, you know. And then I started producing all these different books, many of which were really about sociology, about like exploring the social dynamics of the art world. And then I also realized that everything that I do as an artist kind of has a script. And maybe this comes from performance and from my interest in theater and performance, but I have a very hard time functioning when I have not really come up with a script to what I'm going to do. And the script can be a very loose conceptual structure, or it can be something very literal, like really like a story that I have to really play out, you know. But I, to me, it's narrative and the sequential structure is absolutely central to where everything that I do. And that's why, you know, when I try to get inspired, I've been going to museums. I mean, I work in a museum. You know, I see a museum every single day. But when I really need inspiration, I actually go into a used bookstore, or I go into like try to find like models in literature, in writing, that could be have an interesting translation, let's say, into the visual arts.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, and I'm also sorry to hear about your brother, which I didn't know of. That's of course very, very sad, and I'm sorry to hear that. It's also very interesting that as an almost, you know, mentor in that respect, that your writing career took off after his death. It sounds like it was very much influenced by who he was.
Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up in a literary family, essentially, you know, of a family of mostly writers and poets and things like that. You know, being a conceptual artist in that context was very strange, you know, and for my family it was very difficult to understand what the hell I was doing, you know. When I did my first performance, they almost got offended because they didn't really understand what the hell that I was attempting to do. And for a while, I was really trying to reconcile conceptual art and more kind of experimental forms of art making with the, I guess, more traditional, perhaps, modernist aesthetic that I was inheriting from the writing world, you know, because, again, my family was into writing, but, you know, they were more like more modernist, I guess, more purists, you know, in the traditional forms that were not experimental writers. So, as a result, I guess I became very interested in history and evaluating that history, you know. But my work has then become kind of a complex negotiation between that past and that legacy and the history with the present, you know, and trying to make it in ways that are unexpected. So the bookstore, for example, the Libreria Gonzalez is another example of that, where, you know, you walk into this bookstore and you are really, in a way, transported to us to a past. It kind of looks like a living room of some eccentric book collector, you know, and from, you know, maybe 50, 60 years ago. And I kind of like that that environment, you know. But at the same time, you know, even though it embodies this past, or it inhabit or tries to inhabit this format, it's the fact that it's being done today in 2016 or 17 is very important, you know, because it really, I think, tries to offer a different way of looking at reality, you know, looking at history and reinterpreting history to kind of come up with something new. This is my hope.
That's my hope too. I'm so glad we talked about that as well. Pablo, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure talking about your work and also having you read.
Thank you, Brainerd. It's been a pleasure, and let's hope for a better 2017.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.